I'm Marco Werman, and I want to take a moment to say thank you. Thank you to everyone who has stepped up to support this show in the last few weeks. And if you have not yet, don't worry, you can still right now. Just head to theworld.org/match and make a gift of any amount today. That's theworld.org/match. And thanks. The Trump administration says North Korea needs to give up its nuclear weapons, but that's looking unlikely.
From a North Korean perspective, it would be nice if their relationship with the United States changed, but I think they think their only true and steady friend are nuclear weapons.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Cape Verdean musician Maroka Parrish has worked with the late Cesaria Evora and Madonna. He met the Material Girl thanks to her love for Cesaria, the barefoot diva of Cape Verde.
When we met, she became like a big fan of Cesaria and the music of Cape Verde.
And scientists pull a Danny DeVito and answer the question, how many Christmas lights would it take for your house to be seen from space?
We all know that this was a fairly ridiculous experiment to begin with, and that Santa Claus already knows where all the good boys and girls live.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on this Christmas Eve. As we've been reporting this week, North Korea has sent a warning that it might be preparing an unwelcome Christmas gift for the United States. Today, President Donald Trump was asked about that. He was at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida, and he appeared to brush away the concern.
That's okay. We'll find out what the surprise is, and we'll deal with it very successfully. Let's see what happens. Everybody's got surprises for me, but let's see what happens. I handle them as they come along.
So how did we get to this point with North Korea? Here's The World's Chris Wolf.
You could say that Donald Trump inherited a pre-existing condition from Barack Obama. In 2016, North Korean television announced a hydrogen bomb test. The H-bomb, of course, can destroy entire cities. North Korea was also perfecting missiles to reach the United States. Jeffrey Lewis, a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Affairs in Monterey, says this would have presented a huge challenge for any incoming administration.
An adversary of the United States had not acquired the ability to hit the U.S. with a nuclear weapon since China did more than 30 years ago.
Obama ramped up sanctions against North Korea, but Donald Trump put them into overdrive. Sung-yun Lee teaches Korean affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
Throughout 2017, the Trump administration did the right thing in that for the first time in history, the United States tried to galvanize the international community to put maximum financial pressure on North Korea.
Trump's maximum pressure policy also included threats of more severe consequences.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
But North Korea responded in kind. There were more missile tests and more gushing on North Korean television. As 2017 wore on, it seemed like war was a real possibility. Then, says Sung-yun Lee, Kim offered an opening.
The conventional wisdom, at least on the part of the Trump administration, is that the so-called policy of maximum pressure and engagement compelled Kim Jong-un to back down.
But Lee says that's not actually what happened.
Everything was preordained, planned by North Korea, and we've seen this pattern before. After a period of provocations through graduated escalation, all of a sudden, the very weird, bellicose North Korean leader changes his tune and engages the world, and everyone takes the bait.
Trump jumped at the chance and decided to meet face-to-face with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, in Singapore.
The president looked for the big, showy meeting that the whole world would be focused on, without paying any attention to the details.
Victor Char of Georgetown University led U.S. negotiations with North Korea in the administration of George W. Bush.
Those meetings, those summit meetings, should be the end result of a careful negotiation. They shouldn't be the beginning of the negotiation.
So in reality, not much was really accomplished, says Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute.
There was very little that was agreed in Singapore. You know, it was a very short, aspirational statement. The administration has adopted this phrase, the complete and verifiable denuclearization of North Korea as agreed by Chairman Kim in Singapore. But in fact, Kim didn't agree to any such thing.
Suzanne DiMaggio also has experience of negotiating with the North Koreans. She's at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and says the U.S. lost an opportunity.
President Trump made a breakthrough with Kim Jong-un, something that no other American president has been able to do. But instead of moving forward with a workable strategy, he stuck to an approach that was doomed to fail.
Not surprisingly, subsequent talks also failed. Jeffrey Lewis says the administration never understood a key part of North Korea's motivation: survival.
If you're Kim Jong-un, you look around at the world and you see what happened to Gaddafi and Saddam, two dictators that did disarm. And I don't think you can conclude from either experience that cutting a disarmament deal with the United States is good for one's health. Their only true and steady friend are nuclear weapons.
Suzanne DiMaggio at Carnegie says, in fact, Kim Jong-un has taken full advantage of his relationship with Trump.
What's important to understand is even though Trump and Kim Jong-un have been meeting in these elaborate settings, have been exchanging love letters, make no mistake about it, the North Koreans have used this time to advance their nuclear program and their missile program in very substantial ways.
The U.S. remains empty-handed, but it is learning to live with a nuclear-armed North Korea. The future, then, seems to be one of deterrence and containment. Right now, North Korea is making veiled threats about another weapons test. Sung-yoon Lee at Tufts, however, is not too worried about any Christmas surprise. In any case, he says the U.S. does not have any options.
Even if Kim Jong-un were to conduct a nuclear test tomorrow on Christmas Day, yes, there would be umbrage, there would be fiery rhetoric out of the White House. But after about 3 months, especially in an election year, if Kim Jong-un beamed smiles and said, let's talk, I changed my mind, let's talk again, it would be impossible for Trump not to take that bait.
For the world, I'm Chris Wolfe.
And now an update to a story you heard just yesterday on the show. It was about an English teacher in Syria.
Mohammed says now he spends most of his days in the basement of his home.
That's the world's Shirin Jafari telling us about Mohammed Al-Qassoum, a resident of Idlib province in northwest Syria. Since last week, Idlib has been under intense airstrikes by Russian and Syrian warplanes. There are reports of civilian deaths and casualties. Many people have fled the area. Shirin is back with us now, and I gather there have been some developments since your story aired yesterday.
Yes, Marco. When I talked with Mohammed for my story, he told me he's going to stay in his home as long as he can.
I have to save it from the thieves too, not only from the bombing, from the thieves.
He says he has to save his home from thieves or looters, as well as the bombings. And you might be asking, how could he possibly save his home from bombardment? But when you talk to Mohammed, you quickly realize that he's very attached to his home. Later, I checked in with Mohammed again to see how he's doing. Hi, Mohammed. How are you?
I'm good, alhamdulillah. How are you?
He told me that since we spoke, the airstrikes got too intense and it just became too dangerous for him to stay.
So what did he do?
So he had no choice but to leave his home. He said he packed some food, picked up a couple of blankets, and paid someone to drive him out of the area. He's now staying at a house in Aleppo. That's a city about an hour north of where he lived. He's safe now, but he told me that just a few hours after he left, he found out that his home had been bombed. A friend of his sent him pictures of the house, which is now a pile of rubble.
My heart is broken for that. You know, I lived my life there at that home. Every moment, memory I have there inside that home. And now it's nothing, just nothing.
I mean, that sounds just terrible. As he said, he has all his memories in that home. And home, obviously, for Mohammed, like a lot of people, is everything.
That's so true, Marco. But as sad as Mohammed's story is, he did have some good news to share. One is, of course, that he's safe. And the other, remember in my story, he said he was taking care of 6 orphans and that he had sent them away to a safer area. Well,
the kids, orphans, I'm caring about them, are here, you know, in the house I have rented.
Wow, so the kids are with him in the house he's rented. That's fantastic.
It is, and Mohammed says for now he's going to wait things out in Aleppo.
The world's Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for this update, and with a little glimmer of good news inside.
You're welcome, Marco.
2019 has been chock full of climate change news. Teenagers skipped school to strike for action, activists marched in the streets, celebrities got arrested, and scientists tried to better understand things like ice melt in Antarctica and its connection to sea level rise. Our reporter Carolyn Beeler embedded with some of those scientists earlier this year. We're revisiting those stories this holiday week. Today we pick up with Carolyn's journey as the ship she was on headed into the notorious Drake Passage on the way from South America to Antarctica.
The Drake Passage has some of the roughest waters in the world, and there's just no escaping the effects of its huge swells.
Okay, I'm walking through the hallway on the main deck, where there are labs on either side, getting pushed into the wall.
Every couple seconds, gravity seems to pull me in a different direction as our ship, the Nathaniel B. Palmer, gets tossed by the sea. The hallways run uphill one second and downhill the next. Doors fly open as soon as you turn the handle or become heavy as lead.
Pulling back on the door is like, ugh.
We're 3 days out from port in South America, and I was expecting to be miserably seasick by now. But a combination of seasickness patches, acupressure wristbands, keeping an eye on the horizon, and eating lots of crystallized ginger is keeping my stomach remarkably happy.
Thank you.
So I'm able to head outside as huge waves crash against the side of the ship and send white froth into the air. This is what the Drake Passage sounds like. It's the only broad stretch of open ocean between the Atlantic and Pacific. Trace where we are in a circle around the globe, there'll be no land to interrupt the weather or the wind or break these waves. So these are some of the roughest seas in the world. Right now the boat's listing, pretty heavily with each wave. It's rocking a lot. And this is a pretty mild day. The whole Southern Ocean that surrounds Antarctica is notoriously rough.
And Drake Passage is even worse.
Bastian Quest is an oceanographer at the University of East Anglia.
Because you've got this area where you've got the Antarctic Peninsula coming north and the tip of South America coming south, and they really act like a funnel. And everything just channels in. You've got stronger wind, stronger swell, and everything just builds up to its maximum intensity.
These treacherous waters kept European explorers from reaching Antarctica for centuries after the mysterious land of Terra Incognita was first drawn onto maps. Even today, in a big, sturdy steel ship, it's impossible to ignore the water's power. Heavy equipment is lashed down with ratchet straps and chains or bolted to the decks. Still, occasional 20-foot swells send keyboards skittering across counters and knock people over in their chairs. Everyone's fine.
Okay.
And it can be hard to sleep.
How did it feel last night? It was very sloshy.
Victoria Fitzgerald is a University of Alabama PhD student.
We were sliding head to toe in the bed. I kind of like clung to my sheets like a baby koala. Just hanging on for dear life.
Then there's the kitchen.
Right now, the Drake is getting the best of us.
Chef Julian Isaacs stands in a lunge as he shapes meatballs so he doesn't tumble over.
Oh yeah, we have a lot of things crashed to the floor today. So we were quick to pick them up, throw them in the sink, secure them real quick, you know. For the most part, we're getting there.
While I'm in the kitchen, a big roll knocks pots and pans around and sends dinner ingredients across the floor.
Avocado down. Just hit you in the leg.
Finally, toward evening on our roughest day on the Drake, the Palmer's rocking slows. I head up to the bridge for a panoramic view of the calming ocean.
We've survived the Drake.
Rick Wimkin is the ship's chief mate.
So now should be fairly smooth sailing from here on out. On down to the ice.
We've nearly finished crossing the roughest part of the Southern Ocean. For centuries, these waters have protected Antarctica from human interference. But now, warmer currents in the very same waters are melting the continent's ice shelves from below. And the scientists on this ship are heading south to try to figure out how quickly it's happening and how much climate change is to blame. But our challenges from the sea are far from over. Floating sea ice will subdue the waves, but it could also lock us out of places scientists want to go. Like lots of things down here, we'll just have to wait and see. For The World, Carolyn Beeler aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer, sailing toward Antarctica.
Wow, what an adventure. Tomorrow, Carolyn takes us crashing through that floating sea ice and to Antarctica itself. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. If you're a regular listener to The World, then you've heard me make the case for supporting the work we do. We're here every day covering the global news that we think matters most to you. The current news cycle is fast and can be overwhelming. That's why at The World, we take the time to go deeper and bring you the human stories behind the biggest events of our time. Perspective matters, and if you value the perspective The World brings, then please act now. Join other listeners like you and make a donation at theworld.org/match. It doesn't matter how much you give, it just matters that you do. That's theworld.org/match, and thank you for your support. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. On this Christmas Eve, as we contemplate the mystery of Santa Claus in this age of electronic surveillance, you might be wondering if the guy in the red suit can really see your house from up there.
Daddy, come look!
You can see every house in the country from space.
Where's our house?
You can't see our house.
Just hoping that one day I'd do something big.
That's Danny DeVito in the 2006 film Deck the Halls, trying to create the ultimate display of Christmas lights that could actually be seen from space. Well, students at the University of Leicester in the UK decided to take on this holiday challenge for real. Lee Fletcher is an associate professor of planetary science there.
We all know that this was a fairly ridiculous experiment to begin with, in that Santa Claus already knows where all the good boys and girls live.
Still, four physics students, or let's just call them Santa's little helpers, wanted to calculate the number of Christmas lights needed to make a house visible from above the Earth's atmosphere.
What our students used as a guide was the International Space Station. If someone was up there looking down upon the planet Earth at nighttime, would they be able to see your house with those Christmas lights on its roof? And they came up with a number of about 2,500 Christmas lights.
Wow, 2,500 is all it takes? Doesn't sound like that many to be spotted from space. Santa is definitely not going to see my house tonight.
But one thing I want to point out is that we at the University of Leicester are not advocating that you all rush out to the supermarket now to buy extra lights.
Ah, great point. Fletcher says that cheap holiday lights are kind of bad for the environment. And besides, wouldn't it be more considerate on this silent night not to be your neighbor's source of noisy light pollution?
The very special opportunity tonight for us to look up and see Santa Claus and his reindeers as they fly across the night sky on their journey around the world.
They think it's safe to say Santa would appreciate cookies and milk by the tree tonight more than thousands of lights. Over the years, I've spoken with many musicians from Portugal and Cape Verde, but I never thought I'd be asking any of them this question. You were percussionist for Madonna. How many times have you performed together?
Whoa, we are about 40 shows.
That's a
almost
lot.
50, I know. Actually, on her show, I do many different percussion instruments, but also I do guitar on her show.
That's Miroca Parrish. He's right. He's a man of many talents. Singer, songwriter, and yes, gifted guitarist and percussionist. As for his work with Madonna, Miroca Parrish was lucky that the Material Girl moved to Lisbon a couple of years ago so her son could train with an elite soccer team there. That's how Parrish and Madonna met and shared a love of the late Cesária Évora. Miroca Parrish played in her band. Madonna had wanted Cesária to sing at her wedding and birthday. Cesária said no both times, by the way. But before we talked about Madonna, Miroca Parrish told me why he left his home islands of Cape Verde for Portugal when he was 18. It was 1998.
Cape Verde was really so hard back in my time. It was really so hard even to get an instrument, even to get a pick to play a guitar, or even to get a string. It was really hard. I would make all my drums by hand. And then when we moved to Portugal, it was really, really much better. We helped a lot of people also because my granddad was sending a lot of instruments back to the islands. Actually, back in beginning 60, my granddad was the first person who brought the electric bass to the whole country.
How did that change your music, leaving Cape Verde and arriving in Portugal?
Yeah, in the way of the context, the story, the people I met, the tours I did, the experience I got. And also, when you leave people back, you want to bring everyone with you. It was a happiness move I did, but also it was hard because some people just stay behind.
Yeah. I wonder if whether you had stayed in Cape Verde, whether you would have had this relationship with Madonna. You've had this working relationship with Madonna. How did you two meet?
I believe that Madonna was so curious about Cesario's popularity. She came to our backstage. The first time was in London more than 10 years ago.
Aside from Cesario Evora, what did Madonna tell you was kind of at the root of her infatuation with Cape Verde music?
When we met, she became like a big fan of Cesario and the music of Cape Verde. Inclusive on her show, she sang one of the songs of Cesario, became popular in the Cesario's vocal and Cesario's set list. We met long years ago, but she didn't recognize me on time because back in then I have the long hair. And the coincidence is she came to Lisbon, and when they contact me, they didn't know I was the same person. That was good for me because that is like recognizing all the work I did. I wasn't called because I made part of Cesario's band. It's because what I was still playing in Lisbon when I met her in Lisbon to do a documentary of her life in Lisbon.
That was the Madame X documentary, if I'm not mistaken, yeah?
Yes, Madame X documentary in Lisbon.
Well, Madonna certainly embraces the music and the lifestyle. Let's hear just one excerpt from Madame X where she talks about music and why she's drawn to Portugal.
I love voices that don't sound human, and I like making things sound robotic. But there always has to be some essence of humanity in everything that I do. And I'd like to think that no matter what, if all the electricity got unplugged and we ran out of oil and we ran out of everything, I could still sit with a candle, play my guitar, and sing my song, and nobody could get in the way with that. 'Cause you're driving me crazy.
What our listeners didn't see in that clip featuring Madonna, she's sitting in a kind of fado cafe with a candle burning. Has Madonna been a good champion for Cape Verdean and Portuguese culture, do you think?
Oh, of course. Mm. She would never admit it, but she does it every time, every day, and even more. But she would never take credit for that.
Cape Verdean musician Maruca Parrish there, a resident of Lisbon. Here's a single from his latest album. The song is called Mundo Amor, Love World. Prova d'amor, batujem. Conforme paz, amor, na mundo. Não tem viver nesse mundo. Paz e harmonia na coração. Modo um tamo, cá tem ninguém. Ninguém tá mais ninguém assim mesmo. Cá querer mudar é situação. Desamor, paixão e mima boa. Amor é para tu gente. Amor é mima boa. O tem que lembrar que uma boa é quem acreditou. Fazer amor que não fazer guerra não. What a lovely track. That's Cape Verdean singer-songwriter Maruca Parrish there. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Latino families in Houston, Texas have been waiting patiently for the guy in the red suit to show up on Christmas Day. We're talking about the local legend that is Pancho Claus.
When you saw Pancho Claus coming, everybody was excited. He brings that cultural aspect because he does represent our community.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The holidays, of course, are a time for families to come together and appreciate what they have. Not everyone is so lucky, though. For one family we reached out to in Tanzania, this is going to be an especially tough Christmas season. The World's Halima Gikandi has a story.
Every Christmas, Edwin Magoti's family comes together at their ancestral home in Bunda, Tanzania. It's a long trek for Edwin, who lives hours away in the country's largest city of Dar es Salaam. But it's a family tradition. Edwin's parents are expecting him, and his siblings will be there.
The Christmas day, we normally go to church on the morning hours up to 12 noon, and then we have a family gathering at home.
Like families around the world, the Magotis have a large dinner on Christmas Day.
We eat together, we drink together, we enjoy together as a family.
The day after Christmas, the Magotis have a family meeting where they talk about how the year went and what they're looking forward to. But this year, one person will be absent from the meeting. It's Edwin's younger brother, Tito Magoti. Tito is a well-known human rights activist in Tanzania who disappeared on Friday. He went shopping and suddenly, according to witnesses, five men pulled Tito into a car. And he was gone. When Edwin heard the news, he immediately called his brother's employer, Anna Henga. Henga is with the Legal and Human Rights Center in Tanzania. She says at first, she thought Tito must have been abducted.
So we thought it is an abduction. We made a lot of noises to bring Tito back. There was big campaigns on Twitter and social media. Free Tito, free Tito, free Tito. Bring back Tito.
News of Tito's disappearance spread on social media. Hours later, the police in Dar es Salaam released a message.
Tito Magoti hakutekwa.
A police commander said Tito was not abducted. He was arrested. But Anna Henga, Tito's boss, says the police commander was not clear about why he was being held.
He didn't mention the offenses. He didn't mention where they're interrogating him.
Henga and the Magoti family were confused. They visited every police station in the city, but Tito was nowhere to be found. On Monday, a group of human rights organizations filed a lawsuit. They demanded that the police either release Tito or charge him. According to Henga, police had broken Tanzanian law by holding Tito for more than 90 hours without charging him. This morning, police finally did charge Tito, along with one of his colleagues, with money laundering and organized crime. Edwin, the brother, says the charges are ridiculous. But human rights activist Anna Henga says they're part of a larger pattern that the government uses against critics.
People getting arrested, they disappear, you don't see them. Or if you make noises, then the police would come and say, we have them. And then thereafter, they are charged with very difficult offenses, like criminal, organized, or economic crimes.
Economic crimes are difficult to fight in Tanzania. They can take years in the courts. In July, something similar happened to a prominent investigative journalist. Eric Hapendera disappeared from his home, and it was later learned that he had been taken by plainclothes police officers. He was charged with financial crimes. And just last week, his court case was postponed for the 10th time. That means Eric Hapendera, like Tito Magoti, will be in prison for the holidays. Oryem Nyeko is with Human Rights Watch. He says the abductions and arrests are bad news for Tanzania.
The very dramatic slide in terms of the respect for basic human rights and respect for issues such as freedom of expression and freedom of the media and civil society in the past 5 or so years since President Magufuli came into power.
President John Magufuli was elected in 2015. And Tanzania's government has since cracked down on free expression. The international community has taken notice by calling out Magufuli's government on human rights violations. Edwin says he never thought his brother Tito could go to jail for educating Tanzanians about their rights. He says Christmas is going to be a tough time this year for his family and others.
It won't be the same because Tito will be missing and some of us will be missing. So there's no way it's going to be the same.
For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
We're going to revisit a conversation now that only our podcast listeners may have previously heard. When Fleur Pieretz and Julian Boom got married in 2017, only 22 countries worldwide allowed same-sex marriage. The two women, Fleur and Julian, thought, why not get married in all 22 of them? But after their fourth wedding in Paris, Julian was diagnosed with brain cancer, and she died about 7 weeks later. But the story did not end there. Fleur Pieretz completed the wedding journey in a new children's book, Love Around the World. She told me she met her wife at a party in Amsterdam.
And we fell in love instantly, and which was kind of weird because I have been married to a man for 10 years and suddenly I fell in love with a girl. So I was labeled a lesbian, which was kind of weird at the time. The thing was, we were both artists, so we decided to work together, and over time we became more and more activists and advocates for LGBT rights.
So how did this whole idea get hatched, to get married in 22 different nations? And I should point out that as of now, 28 countries now allow same-sex marriage.
Yes. Well, it came about at one evening. We were sitting at a table with four of our friends, very open-minded friends, and they didn't know that we only could get married in 22 countries. So we thought it was very important to make a project about that, because change starts with knowledge. So we thought, if we can get it out there, that number, people are shocked because people think everything is quite all right with LGBT rights, but actually it isn't.
So you were just out at dinner and a light bulb went off and you and Julian said, hey, let's get married 22 times.
Yeah, that's weird, right?
Well, that's a great idea. I mean, this is a really uplifting book, but it also kind of underscores the fact that you're still unable to get married in 170 plus countries. I mean, do you see this book as kind of, it's a children's book, but it's also a work of activism?
It is very much a work of activism, because I would love to point out that you can love whomever you want, you know, because love is love. And what does it matter? Because there are still 71 countries where homosexuality is illegal. In 12 countries, there's a death penalty to homosexuality. That's completely crazy. So I think if that would change a bit, you know, children are our future. These are the ones who have to do it later on. So I think if they can start with an open mind, and hopefully this book is a little part of that.
I mean, these weren't just weddings, though. I mean, they've been described as performance art pieces.
Yes.
Explain what that means. And what that looks
well,
like.
Well, the thing is, of course, we're not going to get married 22 times with a party, because you cannot pay for that. That's so expensive. So we just wanted an official in an official place getting us married, and we will put a camera there and we will just stream it online. So that was the whole project, to do that 22 times in all the different countries. So, but then again, of course, it still stayed very expensive. So we didn't have the money to make the project, but we figured out that if we sold everything we had, we would make it to 5 weddings. And after that, we hoped for an airplane or a bus company to sponsor us in our travel expenses, or we could sleep on people's couches. So we sold everything. We ended up with each one suitcase. But then, of course, after 4 weddings, she died, and I was left with 2 suitcases. That was all I had in the whole world.
One of the striking things about this book are the illustrations by artist Fatina Ramos. You both depict cultures of these different places so vividly in writing and in pictures. Do you have one favorite wedding of the 4 that you had with Julian, and what made it your favorite?
It was the U.S. because
really?
I'm from Belgium. She's from Holland, but we really decided that New York had to be the first wedding, because the thing is, you know, in Belgium and Holland, people are like, don't be crazy. You know, every idea that you have is very easily pointed out as megalomaniac. So when we told our story in New York, everybody was like, oh, wow, you're crazy, but it's great. So we actually needed that U.S. energy to get it started.
I feel a kinship there. My mom got married at City Hall in New York.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so great.
Fleur Peretz, the author of Love Around the World, a new children's book. Thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
Christmas masses inside Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral date back 850 years. They continued through 2 world wars, Nazi occupation, and the aftermath of the city's deadly terror attacks in 2015. But the holiday ritual could not withstand the massive fire this spring that brought down the cathedral's roof and spire and made it near impossible for anyone to enter.
We are very sad, of course. The mass in Notre Dame, I don't have the words to describe how magnificent it is.
Karine Dahl is with the Archdiocese of Paris.
The fact that tonight it is closed and it is dark inside, it's quite a historic moment.
Dahl says Notre Dame has held services every Christmas since 1803.
When the French Revolution happened, there was no mass in the church.
It's unclear when Notre Dame will open again. Dahl says it could take years to restore. But Christmas masses will go on. Singers and congregants have moved to the nearby church of Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois, a place once meant for royalty, and they brought a bit of Notre Dame with them, the cathedral's 14th-century Virgin of Paris, a statue. It stood within feet of the falling roof and flying debris from April's fiery blaze.
Amazingly, the Virgin has not been touched, so it's very significant to be able to transfer it so that people can have something from Notre Dame again in front of their eyes, so that people can pray in front of her. Magnificat anima
mea Domini. Here's another Christmas tradition. Families from Latino communities in the Texas cities of Houston, Lubbock, and San Antonio have been looking out for him for weeks. He is Pancho Claus. He's become a treasured holiday tradition. Elizabeth Troval has a story of the man who's brought a distinctly Chicano flair to the role of Saint Nick.
Generations of Houstonians know when you hear the rumble of his lowrider, Pancho Claus must be close by. In a red zoot suit and fedora, Pancho Claus makes his grand appearance in his 1972 Cadillac Eldorado. At Houston's George R. Brown Convention Center, he throws toys out into bleachers full of 2,000 school children before taking the stage. Richard Reyes has embodied Pancho Claus for nearly 40 years. It goes back to a tragedy in his own life when his sister was killed in a drive-by shooting that inspired him to start working with kids in Houston's historically Latino Second Ward. At one point, Reyes was asked to write a Christmas play. He wanted to incorporate things like the Zoot Suit comeback happening in Houston at the time.
I patterned the whole story on the night before Christmas, but Chicano style. Like, there's no chimneys in the second ward here, so he busts in through the bathroom window.
Little did he know, a Houston legend was born. Each year, Pancho Claus added something new. He started a Pancho Claus band, he coordinated gift collections and giveaways, and he does something extra special on Christmas Day.
We're going to go out with lowriders and crews, and we go out to the poorest neighborhoods that we can find and just randomly give out gifts and come through, making a lot of noise, have police escorts.
Over the decades, he's reached tens of thousands of kids. Crystal Ramirez is an elementary school counselor and still remembers the day 26 years ago when Pancho Claus visited her school.
The cafeteria was full of students. He came in, he sang, he danced, we got teddy bears. And for us as students, it meant the world because we felt like Santa was in the building because he is the Santa.
She says Pancho Claus meant a lot to her as a kid and still does today.
In the Hispanic community and the community I grew up in right there in Southeast Houston, he was it. When you saw Pancho Claus coming, everybody was excited. He brings that cultural aspect because he does represent our community and he does give back to so many community causes within the neighborhood.
She says it's emotional to share Pancho Claus with her own students now. She joins them at an annual event which gives out thousands of toys, like basketballs and stuffed animals, to some of Houston's low-income students.
This group is called Navidad en el Barrio, and they give a good amount of presents to every kid here. There's 2,000 of them.
The event is a long-standing tradition for Pancho Claus, and Reyes continues to perform here, which is no small thing. In recent years, Reyes has had not one, but three heart attacks. It's got him thinking about who will carry on his tradition. Reyes has been a father to Rene Hernandez since he was a kid. Now Hernandez works with Reyes and performs in the Pancho Claus band.
Like during numbers, he would look at me and get off the mic, and then I'd jump in and he'd walk off stage and I'd be doing his thing. And then after the shows, he'd like to tell the audience, if you guys are wondering about the future of Pancho Claus, you just got a glimpse of it.
Hernandez says he imagines updating the look a bit. Tighter pants, a more modern fedora. But he says no matter what, the spirit of Pancho Claus will live on.
And that's what Pancho Claus has always been about. He's always said that Pancho Claus is not him. It's the people that put the events together. It's the mom and dads that bring the kids to events. It's everybody.
In the meantime, Richard Reyes says he plans to stay Pancho Claus for the foreseeable future. for the World. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
The Cayman Islands in the Western Caribbean, it's an autonomous British overseas territory. That means it's one of the last remnants of the British Empire when Britain claimed to have ruled the seas. They're technically under the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom, but the Cayman Islands govern their own internal affairs. Right now, islanders are engaged in a fierce debate over whether to redevelop their main port. The project would be initially paid for by a group that includes the world's two biggest cruise companies, Royal Caribbean and Carnival. Seafaring has come a long way since the glory days of the British Empire, but environmentalists fear the new port would cause irreversible damage to the country's prized coral reefs, and the issue is soon to be put to a public vote, as the BBC's Vivian Nunes now reports from Grand Cayman.
It's another busy morning here in the port at Georgetown. Hundreds of tourists are disembarking from the small boats that ferry them to and from the enormous cruise ships that are docked in the harbour. The passengers come off the boats and come into the port where there are tour operators trying to attract business. They're offering tours to Seven Mile Beach, Stingray City, snorkel tours. Lots of business being done here. Tourists board the minibuses and are taken off around the island.
The Cayman Islands are a popular destination for Caribbean cruisers, and on most mornings here, towering white ships many stories high roll into the aquamarine waters of Georgetown Harbour. The cruise industry helps employ around 5,000 Caymanians and brings in $200 million a year to government coffers. But there's a problem. The world's two biggest cruise companies, Royal Caribbean and Carnival, have decided they've had enough of the small ferries bringing passengers to shore. Instead, they want to build a large concrete pier to make disembarking quicker and easier. If it goes ahead, it will mean dredging the harbour and destroying 10 acres of coral reef. TJ O'Sullivan is from Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines.
We know that a pier is much better for the guest experience. It allows us to utilize the destination in a much more convenient manner. The guests will come off the ship at a much higher rate. The guests will spend more time in port.
That's an ad sponsored by the Cayman Islands government. It's backing the new cruise berthing facility, but conservationists, marine scientists and local business people are desperately trying to stop it. Nadia Hardy is from the Cayman Islands National Trust.
All this is technically at the moment a protected marine park. It's just absolutely beautiful. It's pristine reef. We're facing climate change threats. There's been coral bleaching a few years ago, and this reef is still doing actually really well. And for us to sort of envisage destroying 10.3 acres of it is really concerning for the National Trust.
The consortium behind the project has contracted a company to help relocate some of the coral further along the shore. They've also hired Dr. David Vaughan, a Florida-based marine consultant, who says he can use fragments of the coral removed from the excavated reef to grow new corals elsewhere around the island.
So this is a new technology. It's called microfragmentation, and sometimes called fusion or reskinning of the tissue back on a dead coral head or a rock. It's not the reason that the referendum should be chosen yay or nay, but it is something that they are going to add to the mix to be a gift to the country.
But the science behind coral relocation is hotly debated. Not all marine biologists are convinced it can work. Dr. Terry Hughes is a coral expert. He's been studying reefs since the 1970s.
It's incredibly expensive and very difficult to move corals. They often break apart and are injured fatally when you try to detach them from the substrate.
Not far from where the ferries dock, the Margaritaville Bar offers cruise ship passengers relief from the rising temperatures outside. So what do passengers make of plans to build the new pier?
Piers are easy because you just walk off. This is difficult because it's tenders. And it hurts business because sometimes they can't get the passengers off the ship.
But many local tour operators are unconvinced. They say cruise companies already take most of what passengers spend on the island by pre-selling them tours on board the ships. They're worried that by funding the redevelopment of the port, the cruise companies will have even more control of the local tourism sector.
We will be left out. Pre-books would increase more. I mean, they will force us out of business.
It would be detrimental to the local people.
Detrimental?
It wouldn't be nice for those guys to gain any kind of power here, because right now the local people would suffer if they get any kind of power.
Hi, my name is Mario. I work as a scuba instructor at Eden Rock Diving Center in Grand Cayman. Unfortunately, they'll be digging a lot. They'll be expanding also the cargo area. So all that silt and sand will eventually start making its way over our reef just in front on shore here. And eventually the reef is going to die, and Eden Rock and other businesses that rely on that reef will eventually have to shut down because nothing will be alive anymore.
CPR Cayman, a grassroots group leading the campaign against the project, argues that cruise ship passengers bring in just 20% of the island's annual tourism revenue. Far more money comes from the overnight tourists who stay in hotels. Spokesperson Michelle Lockwood says the government should be focusing its efforts on attracting more of those visitors instead of bowing to pressure from the cruise lines.
Overnight tourism is really where the money's at, and luxury stay tourists even more so. And I think that we have a beautiful island and beautiful, beautiful views that attract that kind of tourist.
Moses Kirkconnell is Deputy Premier of the Cayman Islands.
So the balance that we have to understand from a government policy is, how do we balance the need of the people for a job and opportunity compared to our environment that we have to protect for the next generation?
Here's Michelle Lockwood again.
The cruise lines are a listed company. They're in this for profit. They're in this for their bottom line. They're not in this for what is best for the Cayman Islands. And if it suits them to leave the Cayman Islands, then they will.
Caymanians are expected to vote on the proposal early next year.
The BBC's Vivian Nunes reporting from Grand Cayman. Leaving you today with some meditative and jazzy guitar lines. This is another one of our top albums of 2019. The full list is at theworld.org. It's French guitarist Stéphane Rembel reproducing the little-known improvisations by the great Django Reinhardt. This is from Rembel's album Django l'Impressionniste. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening, and happy Christmas Eve, everybody. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.